get a little piano in our afternoon. Blown kisses are magical. They can cross space and time. My name is Swan, and I'm blowing you kisses from the basement of the Velo Bike Shop from Bushwick, Brooklyn. And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. On today's show, I'm going to jump right in because I think we'll have so much to talk about and time will fly. My guest is Sharon Guskin, and she is the author of her debut novel, Forgetting Time. She's also written and produced award-winning documentary films and holds degrees from Yale University and the Columbia University of the Arts. And she lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two sons. How are you, Sharon?
Hi, Swan. Good to be here on your show.
Yeah, thanks for making time in your afternoon. I know it's a busy weekend. So your first book, The Forgetting Time, just came out from Flatiron Publishing and is out in the world, and it's being received very well. Will you please tell us a little bit about the novel? And you have an excerpt that you wanted to read.
Sure, absolutely. So the novel, The Forgetting Time, it's inspired by some real research that was done and is still being done at the University of Virginia, their Division of Perceptual Studies, as it's called. And basically, a psychiatrist called Dr. Ian Stevenson, who used to be the head of the whole psychiatric program at University of Virginia, began researching these cases of very young children who seem to have concrete memories of previous lifetimes. Basically, there'd be a child, say, in Thailand, who would say, you know, my name isn't the name that was given to me, you know, and this is my real name, and I used to sell these two kinds of incense, and I lived by the river, and I was driving my bicycle one day, carrying the incense, and I was hit by a truck, and I died. Mm-hmm. And basically, what Dr. Stevenson, who became really obsessed with these cases and spent decades of his life on them, and his colleagues, they would go, and they would eventually like research and locate the village and the real person that seemed to fit the description of all these verified statements that the child made and the statements that were witnessed. And then often they would take the child to this town, and the child could identify places and people. And so I'm really not getting into the cases too much right now here, but they're extraordinary cases. And there's, you know, as I said, almost 3,000 of them. And so I just found them just a fascinating subject to sort of delve into these children who seem to be so drawn to families from previous lifetimes and what it would be like to be a mother of a child like that. And so I developed this story about a skeptical single mom in Brooklyn whose four-year-old son is kind of haunted by a previous life and drawn to his family from that life. And the journey that she takes on, along with a scientist kind of inspired by Dr. Stevenson, to try to locate this family. And that's kind of an overview of the book. Mm-hmm. The part that I was thinking of reading today has to do with Dr. Anderson's first case, the first time he sort of discovered this phenomenon.
Great.
It's a little different from the rest of the book in that it's set in the past a bit in Thailand, and I guess the only thing anyone listening needs to know is that they mention in passing Shanti Devi. Shanti Devi was a real case. It was a real little girl in India who had so many statements and even about a previous lifetime and even spoke the language of a previous lifetime, so the dialect, that Gandhi himself developed a commission to investigate this, and they found kind of some amazing things. And so they refer in passing to you know, that the two characters, Dr. Anderson and his old friend Ainsley, had studied this case in college. So I'm just going to jump right in, if that sounds good to you.
Yeah, perfect.
Thailand, 1977, The River. It was early morning and the day already warm. Anderson was eating breakfast with his old friend Bobby Ainsley on the veranda of his hotel. Up the river toward the city, buttery sunlight bounced off the temple of the dawn, scattering color into the air like a jewel. In front of them, a dog struggled to cross the river, its matted head thrusting above the waves. Anderson was jet-lagged and 3 days sober. His sunglasses gave everything a sickly yellow tint. He focused on his friend, who was flirting with the waitress as she arranged a saucer of clotted cream on the white muslin next to a plate of scones. Her face was perfectly symmetrical, like a face in a dream. Cup, coon, cup, Ainsley said, placing his hands together in a parody of a polite tie. Or perhaps he had become one, Anderson didn't know. He'd seen him only twice since they'd graduated college 10 years before, and each time had been a disappointment to both of them. They were on different paths, Anderson rising quickly within the university, en route to becoming chairman of the psychiatric department within a few years, and Ainsley going in another direction, or rather, as far as Anderson could see, in no direction at all. Anderson had been surprised to find his friend settled anywhere. Since college, he had seemed perpetually on the move, briefly inhabiting the fine hotels and women of major cities from Nairobi to Istanbul, trying and failing to exhaust all that money born of generations of tobacco. They watched the waitress go back through the open doors into the lobby bearing her silver tray. Nearby, a string quartet was playing, the Surrey with the fringe on top. "Look what I brought," Ainsley wagged his ginger eyebrows, reached into a paper bag at his feet, and pulled something out with a flourish, plopping it on the table. The thing slumped against the silver teapot, its legs splayed across the white linen. Bright red yarn hair, striped legs, red circles for cheeks. "You brought me a Raggedy Ann doll?" Anderson stared at it dumbfounded. Gradually, it dawned on him. "It's for today, to give the girl. I was hoping for some kind of porcelain number, but this is what they had. The store's here." He shook his head. "Are you out of your mind? You can't give a doll to the subject of an experiment." Was that what this was? Anderson wondered. An experiment? "For God's sake, man, loosen up. Have a scone." Ainsley took a bite out of a scone as large as a hand, sprinkling crumbs up across the white cloth. His reddish hair was prematurely thinning across the expansive dome of his head, and his features had gone pink and blurry from too much sun and Thai whiskey, giving him a soft, pumpkinish look. Perhaps his brain had gone soft as well. "It's bribery," Anderson frowned. "The girl will say whatever you want her to say." "Consider it a gesture of good faith. She's not going to change her story for Raggedy Ann doll, believe me. At least I don't think so." Ainsley peered at him. "You're hating me under those shades, aren't you?" Anderson removed his sunglasses and blinked bare-eyed at his own white fingers. "It's just that I thought you wanted a scientific approach. I thought that was the point of bringing me here." "Well, we're kind of making it up as we go along, aren't we?" His friend smiled a broad, slightly manic smile with his crooked teeth, as deranged in its way as that of the doll. A mistake, Anderson thought. This was all a mistake. A few days before, he had been in Connecticut, trudging through the snow to his lab. He'd been studying the long and short-term effects of electrical traumatic stimulus on a rat's central nervous system. He'd left the experiment at a crucial juncture. "I thought this was a serious endeavor," he said slowly. The note of complaint rang in the air like a child's. Ainsley sounded hurt. "You didn't put up much of a fight, if I remember correctly, when I asked you to come." Anderson looked away. The dog was still trying to cross the river. Would it make it to shore or drown? Two children exhorted it from the other bank, hopping in the mud. The rank river smell mingled in his nostrils with the floral scent of the tea. What Ainsley said was true. He had been eager to come. It had been a feeling, more than anything else, that had led him here, a wave of nostalgia that had overtaken him the moment he had heard his friend's excited voice in the midst of those bleak months after the baby had died and everything had fallen apart. He and Sheila were in separate hells that hardly spoke to each other. He made it through his days, studied his rats, took down the results as he ought to, drank more than he ought to, yet felt much of himself most days to be no better than the vermin he studied. Actually, the rats had more spark. Ainsley's boyish enthusiasm had traveled the long distance between them, like a memory of the interest he had once had in life and might find again if he took the chance. And in any case, it would be an escape, a respite, the thing he was looking for every night at the bottom of the glass. "I've heard about the most extraordinary thing. It's Shanti Devi all over again," Ainsley had said on the phone. and Anderson had laughed for the first time in months to hear the name. I'll pay your way, of course, in the interest of science. Go, Sheila had said. Her eyes were red-rimmed, accusing. So he had taken it, this chance, this respite. He was taking it. He'd been relieved to leave Connecticut with its oncoming Christmas and its angry, devastated wife. He had told Ainsley nothing of his circumstances, preferring not to discuss it. Shanti Devi, Anderson said now, aloud. It was probably nothing, he knew that. Still, the name was a tonic on his tongue, bringing him back a decade to the taste of beer and youth. It's pretty hard to believe, Ainsley brightened. That's why we're going, so you don't have to. Anderson glanced away from his eager face. The mangy dog had made it across. He was scrambling up the muddy banks of the other side. He shook his fur and the children screamed and scattered, avoiding the droplets of foul water that spun and sparkled in the light. No dolls, Anderson said. Ainsley patted Anderson on the hand. Just meet the girl. The girl lived a few hours north of Bangkok, in a village in Uthai Thani province. The boat sputtered through the slums on the outskirts of the city, then moved past larger, more rural dwellings, wooden houses with piers at the ends adorned with tiny wooden temples, spirit houses for the dead. The harvested rice fields were golden brown on either side of them, dotted here and there with an ambling water buffalo or a small shack. Anderson felt the images taking the place of thoughts in his mind, soothing him, until he was nothing but a white hand skimming the surface of the water. The jet lag was catching up to him at last, and he dozed sitting up, lulled by the hoarse, steady roar of the motor. When he awoke a couple hours later, the air had grown hot and thick in his lungs, and he was blanketed with sunlight. He realized he had dreamed of the baby. In the dream, Owen was whole, a beautiful child, with blue eyes like Sheila's that regarded him pensively. The baby sat up and reached out to him, like the boy he might have been. They approached a small wooden house on stilts, surrounded by lush foliage. How Ainsley identified this particular house from the identical ones that lined the road near the pier was a mystery that Anderson didn't bother solving. An older woman swept the dirt floor in the shadows underneath the house, chickens muttering around her ankles. Ainsley whined to her, his head bowing over his two hands, revealing the naked spot of pink scalp at the center of his skull. The two of them had a discussion. The father's working out in the fields, Ainsley told Anderson. He won't talk. Your tie, it's pretty good, right? Anderson asked. It occurred to him they ought to have hired an interpreter. It's good enough. It would have to be. They climbed the stairs, a simple room, well swept, slatted wooden windows looking out into cropped fields and blue sky. A woman was placing an array of food on a table in battered tin bowls. She was wearing the same kind of brightly patterned cloth the old lady wore, knotted right above her breasts. She was lovely, Anderson thought, or had been, not so long before. Anxiety seemed to have caught her beauty in its net. When she smiled at them, worried lines rippled from her dark eyes, and her crimson lips parted to reveal bright red teeth. Betel nut, Ainsley murmured. They chew it here. Some kind of stimulant. He bowed his neck respectfully, hands together. Sawati, her eyes darted from one of them to the other. Anderson looked for the child and discovered her crouched in the corner, watching the yellow lizards frisking in the ceiling dust. He was dismayed to see that she was wearing nothing. She was frail, almost emaciated, her face and concave belly painted with a white powder he surmised was used to keep away the heat. Two round circles on her cheeks, a line down her nose. The women had laid out a villager's feast for them, white rice and fish curry, though it was only 10 in the morning, and 10 cups of water that Anderson was sure, as he sipped, would make him ill. He couldn't risk offending her, so he filled his roiling stomach, the taste of metal coating his mouth. Outside the window, a man shepherded a water buffalo across a field of golden stubble. The sun barreled through the slats in the windows. Ainsley walked over to the child. Got something for you. He pulled the doll from his bag, and she took it soberly. She held it in her outstretched hands for a moment, then cradled it in her arms. Ainsley lifted his brows meaningfully at Anderson across the room, as if to say, "See, she loves it." They set up at the wooden table, now cleared of breakfast. Two white men, a nervous woman, and a little naked girl who couldn't have been more than three, holding a grotesque red-haired rag doll. She sat quietly next to her mother. She had an uneven birthmark to the left of her navel, like a splash of red wine. She clutched the doll tightly in her hands, watching her mother shave papaya into long, even strips with quick fingers. They talked to the mother. Ainsley spoke in Thai first, and then in English, for Anderson's benefit. "Tell us about Guy." She nodded. Her hands didn't stop moving. The strips fell away from the papaya into a tin bowl. Every time a sliver dropped from the knife, the little girl shuddered. The mother spoke in such a low voice that Anderson was amazed Ainsley could even hear her to translate. "Guy's always been different." His voice, translating, was almost robotic. "She won't eat rice. We try to make her sometimes, but she cries, spits it out." The mother made a face. "It's a problem." There was her tense, thin voice, and then Ainsley's low, flat one. The emotion, then the meaning. "I'm afraid she'll starve." As if reminded of this, she picked up a piece of the papaya from the battered tin bowl and handed it to her daughter. The girl clutched the doll in her left hand and reached for it, gripping it as if with pincers. Anderson saw that three of her fingers on this hand were deformed. It was as if these fingers had been drawn sloppily, in a hurry, without the refinements of nails and knuckles. The girl caught him looking at her fingers and she curled them into a fist. Anderson looked away, ashamed of himself for staring. The mother stopped peeling papaya and let loose a stream of words. Ainsley could barely keep up with her. "My daughter says that last time she lived in a bigger house in Peachit. The roof was made of metal. She says our house is no good. It's too little. It's true. We're poor." She grimaced, lifting a hand to indicate the simple room. The girl stared at them, chewing papaya, and clutched the doll's floppy body more tightly in her hands. "Also, she cries all the time. She says she misses her baby." "Her baby?" The girl was watching her mother talk. She was like a rabbit in a field, listening. "Her little boy. She cries and cries. I want my baby," she says. Anderson felt his heart begin to beat a little faster. His mind, though, remained apart. "How long has she been saying this?" "One year, maybe. We tell her to forget about it. My husband says it's bad luck to think of another life. But still, she talks." She smiled sadly, put down the knife, and stood up as if wiping her hands of the matter. The men stood too. "Just a few more questions." But she was shaking her head, still smiling, retreating through a door in the rear of the room. They watched her shadowy figure stirring something on a low charcoal stove. The child sat at the table, stroking the doll's absurd hair, humming tunelessly. Anderson leaned across the table. "Guy, your mother said you used to live in Peachit. Can you tell me about this?" Ainsley translated. Anderson held his breath. They waited. The girl ignored them, playing with her doll. Its blank button eyes seemed to be mocking them. Anderson walked over to Guy, squatting down next to her chair. She had her mother's high cheekbones under the circles of white powder and her mother's anxious eyes. He eased himself onto the floor and pulled his long legs into a cross-legged position. For a long time, 15 minutes, he simply sat with her. Guy showed him the doll, and he smiled. They began to play silently. She fed the doll and gave it to him to feed. "Nice baby," he said after a while. She tweaked the doll's painted nose affectionately. "A really pretty baby." Anderson's voice was gentle, admiring. He followed Ainsley's Thai tones floating up and down like paper airplanes borne haltingly up and then falling, missing their mark. Who knew if he was saying it correctly? She giggled. "It's a boy. Does he have a name?" "Nung." "Nice name. What are you feeding him?" "Milk." "Doesn't he like rice?" She shook her head. She was only a few inches away from him. He could smell the papaya on her breath and a chalky smell, possibly from the face paint. "Why not?" "Rice is bad. It doesn't taste good." "No, no, no, not good." He waited a moment. "Did something happen while you were eating rice?" "Bad thing happened." "Oh." He was aware of all the sounds in the room. Angsley's voice, the scratching of the lizards as they raced madly across the ceiling, the quick clicks of his heartbeat. What happened? Not now. I see, it happened in another time. When I was big. Anderson looked at the sun sliding through the slats onto the wood floor, the white circles glowing on the child's face. Oh, when you were big, did you live in a different house? In Peachit. I see. What happened there? Bad thing. A bad thing happened with the rice. She reached over the table to the papaya bowl, grabbed a piece of papaya, and shoved it into her mouth. What happened, Guy? She smiled at them, with the fruit covering her teeth. The broad orange smile of a clown. She shook her head. They waited for a long time, but she said nothing else. Out the window, the water buffalo was no longer in sight. The sun set the bright fields on fire. Down below, the chickens chuckled at them. I guess that's it then, Ainsley said. Wait. The girl was reaching again into the bowl of papaya, and this time she took the paring knife her mother had left there. She picked it up with her imperfect hand. They were so rapt, these two grown men watching her. They didn't react at first. They didn't take the knife away from the baby. They watched her pick up the doll, wrap its crude cloth fingers carefully around the knife, and with one focused movement turn the knife toward her body, stopping just before it entered her abdomen, its point grazing the wine-colored birthmark. It was only then that Anderson reached over, prying the knife from her tiny, malformed fingers. She let him take it. She said something else. She was looking up at him, her face urgent beneath the white powder. A ghost child, thought Anderson, a dream. And then he thought, no, she's real. This is reality. There was a pause. Well, what is it? What did she say? Ainsley frowned slightly. I think she said the post. It was late in the day by the time Anderson and Ainsley headed back in the boat. The hired truck that had taken them to and from Peachit had let them off at the riverbank, and now they were returning silently to Bangkok. Anderson stood in the front. Next to him, Ainsley sat and smoked. The boat glided past the shacks with jetties, little spirit houses perched on the ends, miniature temples built for the shelter and appeasement of ghosts, past the women bathing, the children swimming in the muddy river water. Anderson unbuttoned his shirt. He took off his shoes and socks. He needed to feel the water splashing his toes, splashing his ankles. He stood on the boat in his open shirt and T-shirt, the late afternoon sun roaring on his head. Every hair on his body was standing on end. He thought of Arjuna begging the Hindu god Krishna to show him reality, reality, the fire of 1,000 suns simultaneously blazing forth in the sky. He thought of Heraclitus, a man cannot step in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and he is not the same man. He thought of the police and coroner's reports about the mailman from Peachit, who had plunged a knife into the left side of his wife's abdomen, killing her, and cutting through three of the protecting fingers of her right hand because she had burned the rice. Thank you, Swan. That's
yeah, me. My pleasure. Kind of has a different feel than the rest of the novel, which is true, but it's also riveting. If you tuned in at some point in the middle, that was an excerpt from The Forgetting Time from Sharon Guskin's new book. And you can catch the podcast next week on Stitcher, Audio Boom, or iTunes. And this is Ink and Worm. I'd love to talk about something we visited earlier about just like interconnectivity.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned it in referencing a book, you know, you look at an object and see it for what it is as a book, but it's really, you said it beautifully. Do you want to say it again?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's interesting that there's kind of a Buddhist concept called dependent arising that, you know, objects aren't independent the way that we think they are. You know, we might think something's just a shirt or a table, but it's made of all of these different people and all of these different actions and all of these different parts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it really seemed very clear to me that a book is like that too. You know, when I look at the book, it looks like, oh, there's a book and it has my name on it and it's my book. you know, and everyone says, oh, your book. But actually, you know, when I look at it, you know, the book is also Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Tucker's book. It's entirely inspired by their research. And it's Peter Matheson's book because I studied with him as my first writing teacher, and he inspired me, and some of things I've, you know, his works that I've read and been inspired for kind of worked their way in various ways in a feeling, maybe in scenes. And certainly my agent and my editor, particularly my editor, had a huge influence in, I rewrote this book 3 times for her, mm-hmm. For my editor. So it's completely her book, you know, and her intentions, and, you know, my husband and my friends and my colleagues and all the people who supported me, like it wouldn't exist without them. And so, you know, and the various teachers I've had, of all kinds of teachers, from, you know, my meditation teacher who essentially kept me sane and taught me a lot about different concepts, to my writing teachers through the years. So it's really, when I, you know, if I look at it clearly, it's really not this independent thing that's my book. It's really something that's kind of arisen and came about because of so much support and inspiration and influences.
And all, you know? Yeah, so and also your personal life experiences. I mean, you mentioned briefly you worked with hospice, and then you also traveled to Thailand, and I'm sure that that definitely influenced your ability to write and kind of the plot, I imagine, too.
Exactly. You know, I mean, that scene I just read, it's set in Thailand because I went to Thailand, you know, and there are many cases all over the world, but more in Asia. And I thought, well, let's pick an Asian case. Let's pick a Thai case because I knew more of the area. I know what the spirit houses look like. And I went to Thailand because my parents are Peace Corps volunteers in Thailand in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so I had connections and a feeling, and then they went to the Peace Corps in the 60s because of JFK. So, like, JFK is responsible for my scene.
Yeah, in a way he influenced this book existing. That's so funny. I also want to touch base on, you said you rewrote the book 3 times, and as I understand, this also wasn't your first novel. You had written novels before that, for whatever reason, weren't ready to be published. So you, you know, set them aside, and this one actually was, like, you know, a publisher was interested and took it up. But talk a little bit about that process of writing because you're compelled to, and rewriting.
Right. It's, I mean, whether they were, yeah, they weren't quite ready to be published, or the publishing world didn't think that
they yeah, they're ready just, to be they didn't think that the market would be there for that.
Right. I mean, the first one, I think I didn't quite know what I was doing. The second one just didn't have a kind of commercial bone in its body. But I think, you know, I've been writing very seriously for over, you know, I would say like for about 24 years or something. So that's a long time. And I've been, you know, really working on various, you know, these other 2 books and then this one for you know, in a very serious and fairly diligent way. And I have to say, it's been really interesting. If you had asked me, you know, a decade ago, if this is how I want it all to go, I probably would have said, absolutely not. Who would choose to not have 2 books published and to spend so much time writing without getting published? But from my end now, it was actually really super useful because I think with the earlier books, partly at first I didn't know what I was doing, and then my intentions were a little blurry to myself. My intentions were a little blurry even to me. Like I felt that I wanted to impress certain people. I was part of kind of a writer scene in New York mm-hmm. City. I knew a lot of you know, famous and impressive writers, and I wanted to show them how clever I was, or I wanted to get a book out. Mm-hmm. You can't really do anything really good that way, I think.
Yeah.
And I think eventually, you know, after I'd failed twice and, you know, I'm in Park Slope, I know so many writers, that finally I just had to accept, like, I don't know if this is going to happen, but I want to keep writing, and I want to just write the story that I think I want to write, you know, a story that I think would be interesting for people. And I actually think that these cases that Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Tucker investigated are really interesting for people to consider. Like, mm-hmm. maybe this is true. What does that mean for your life if these cases are true and we're reborn? And, you know, I just suddenly thought, well, that's a good reason to write a book. I'm interested in it. I'm fascinated by it. Let's just get the story out. And I, And I kind of let go of this feeling of I needed to validate myself in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I could just give that up, you know. So in a way, it was like the gift of failure, you know, because finally you're like, you know what? I'm going to live my life, and I'm going to be as happy as I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to feel like I'm a worthy, worthwhile human being, whether or not I have a book out in the world. And so I could just focus on the story and not worry about it. And then, of course, this is the one that sort of does get, you know, eventually get out in the world, because I really let go of a lot of that stuff that really can hold
what,
you back.
What genre did they put this in? Is this like a thriller, psychological thriller, or what? Like,
it's so funny. Nobody really knows what it is.
Yeah, it's kind of its own thing.
I don't, you know, I just wrote it as a novel, as like a literary novel that maybe was, you know, gripping. And then Amy Einhorn, who bought the book, who's kind of a well-known publisher, published The Help and Leanne Moriarty's books. And, you know, and she likes books that are sort of tell a good story but are also well-written. And I think she calls it like the sweet spot between literary and commercial. And she was the one that bought it, and I thought, great, you know, hopefully the writing's good, and hopefully it can reach a great audience, and that sounds fantastic. But I never really considered it as a genre novel, in like a, certainly not a thriller, because it's actually quite, it's a very emotional experience reading the book, and I think that the thriller people are going to be a little disappointed.
They're going to be like, no, it wasn't thrilling. It's definitely gripping in a way, but it doesn't have like this heavy suspense air that a lot of thrillers have, you know.
It gets dark, but it's dark in an emotional way, not in kind of a chilly thrillery way.
Yeah.
And so, but it's been on the list of like top 10 crime thrillers you can read, you know,
because there is an element of that.
It just depends how people are looking at it. You know, I think in the Times Book Review, you know, I was really grateful for it. You're grateful to be in the Times at all. And Chelsea Kane had said it was something like gripping and moving. And well, I know exactly what you said, because no author forgets their first New York Times. She said like gripping, deft, and moving. But it was under psychological suspense, like a number of books like that. And I was like, oh, that's interesting that's what they think it is, but I'm not going to argue with anybody. You know, it's sort of, again, it's like this concept of it comes out of, it's just made up of all these different influences.
Yeah.
And it kind of is what you decide it is. So there are people who read it really quickly and think, oh, it's a good read, or it's kind of like a thrillery suspense book. And there are other people who are like, oh my gosh, it changed my whole view of what reality is. And, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure especially
have all kinds of different.
Especially if you had never been exposed to this as a concept before, you know, it's not something that we actively like reference in real life, like, oh, you know, past lives or the possibility of a past life. That's not really part of our culture to talk about. So having exposure to it in a way where it's like, but there are documented cases that have been validated based on facts of, you know, very inexplicable things happening, you know, kids playing instruments that they had never touched and like real things. And so it does challenge, like, okay, so how do you think about that? Like, how do you consolidate that?
Right. I would hope so. You know, that's kind of the goal. And I do think that, like, in this culture, we're really quick to just shut it down. Oh, it's all just like a bunch of woo-woo, you know, nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Tucker have done is they're so diligent. I know Dr. Tucker. He's, like, the most sort of cautious, rational person you'll ever meet.
Of course.
And they're so meticulous.
It'd
and so they're
be.
Just looking at data. They're mm-hmm. looking at these kids made, you know, here's a child who made 30 statements that were verified by witnesses.
And the scars
before
is,
they found the other person. And and they match up.
And the scars know? Are and really so, fascinating, too. You mentioned in your excerpt, you know, she had a scars based on the injury that killed her in the former life. I'm wondering, is there a correlation between traumatic death? Like, it seems like a lot of the deaths were sudden and a little bit traumatic. I mean, death is usually traumatic. But I wonder if that has something to do with, like, the sticking power of kids, like, holding
absolutely.
On to the memory.
Yes, absolutely. You got it. Like, 75% of the kids that seem to remember, first of all, they had some kind of trauma. They had some kind of terrible traumatic death, and that's what's kind of somehow imprinting itself on their consciousness and continuing. And it's true, as you mentioned, Stevenson wrote this whole book called Reincarnation in Biology that's all about the fact that he mapped birthmarks and birth defects on these children who seem to remember, with the modes of death, you know, from the previous personality,
Wow.
you know. So if they were, like, hit by a shovel in the head, and then they'd have, like, a mark on their head when they're reborn. So it's kind of amazing, but somehow they speculate that there's just a consciousness got deeply imprinted by these events, and it carried on for a bit. They most, all of them forget by the time they're 5 or 6, which is part of where the title comes from.
Yeah, which is also interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating that they lose it, you know. And, I mean, of course, you can also say the forgetting time comes from the fact that we all maybe have past lives and we've forgotten them. But Stevenson and Tucker are so, Dr. Tucker is so careful that he won't even say, like, I can't prove that everybody is reborn. I can just show you that these children made these statements, and the only plausible explanation is that it's a past life. And there's actually an interesting Scientific American blog that goes into this called, it's called Are We Skeptics Really Just Cynics? And in it, the blogger is like, you know, I'd like to just disregard all of this research, but I can't dismiss it.
It's
I can't easily dismiss
it. Yeah. Well, and also, I don't know if we mentioned, but there's well over 2,000 cases documented, more in Asia because it's something they're more comfortable, you know, accepting, I guess. But, I mean, that's pretty significant.
It's a lot.
When I was reading the book, something that I really appreciated was there were certain lines that would just jump out to me, almost as a type of poetry. I could name a few examples, but one of them is, one of the characters is working with elderly, and she talks about going into work and helping one of the patients, and she's like, there's something calming about being able to touch one this way without any hunger or discussion, just skin on skin. And I think that there's these little moments throughout the book where it's just like, oh, that's like more like pause and I have to like sit with it. Did you have that experience when you're writing of just like lines like hitting you like poetry rather than like, I don't know, storyline?
I feel like for any prose writer, there's no better compliment than that something sounds like poetry. So I'm glad that you had that experience. I think, you know, part of the job for me with this is to try to balance keeping the story moving with the language. I love beautifully written works and sort of I'm interested in language mm-hmm. as a writer. I'm certainly interested in kind of the music of how something flows. So I tried to keep that in there as much as I could, while still very conscious that in this particular case, I needed to be aware that this is a story that needed to keep moving in order to sort of kind of get people through it.
Yeah.
And so it really was a balance. And there were some things, you know, the whole idea of killing your darlings, there were some things that I mm-hmm. really loved that I did have to take out. But I'm glad that there are some moments that you experienced.
Well, and part of that experience was the community of people who were helping you write it. I remember you telling me that you had given it to a few trusted friends. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Do you want to share that?
It was actually, I could talk a little bit. Well, at one point, the book was like almost 100 pages longer, like 75 or 80 pages longer. And my editor had read it, and she said, you know, I think you could really cut 75 pages or more.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I had thought I was done. I don't know. You know, if you like hand in something and you feel like I did it, I nailed it, I thought I was done. And so I was really taken aback by this letter. And I just thought, I don't think she's right. I think she's wrong. And so I said, okay, I'm going to give it to my friends and see what they think. And I gave it to my friends. I was like, okay, you know, I don't remember. I was like, maybe 4 people. And I was like, oh, please read this and tell me what you think and call me when you're done. And they said, okay, great. And then I didn't hear from them for a while, so I called them all up. And they're like, oh, it's fantastic. I love it. It's great. Nothing wrong with it. And I said, oh, did you finish? Well, no. You know, but I'm really busy right now. It's not the book at all. I'm really busy right now. So then I waited a little longer, and I called them all back up. I was like, so how's it going? And they're like, oh, I'm really loving your book. I was like, did you finish it? No, I just my life is so crazy right now, and it's really not you, it's not your book. And finally I thought, okay, I just asked every single one of them, well, where'd you stop reading? And every single one of them had stopped at the exact same moment, which is right before I had this like 75-page flashback that actually kind of began with what I read, mm-hmm. but it just kept going and going and going, and there were different cases, and I loved it, but it just stopped. It stopped the book in its tracks. So then I thought, okay, I've got a speed bump, which I don't want, and I cut it by 2/3, and I moved it, and then from then on, people had no problem finishing the book. And actually, people seem to read it quite quickly. In fact, I'm happy to hear that you sort of paused moments over the language, because I was surprised that people are like, oh, I read it all in 2 days. Or,
yeah,
you know.
Well, it's so definitely a page-turner. At some point, you're like, I need to know what's going to happen.
So now it's like a slick the road, I guess, or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that was really, it's really helpful to have that community out there. And I mean, there are friends who've read like so many drafts of this book that I don't even think they've read the final one, but I don't blame them.
They're like, I got the gist. I'm sure it's better. Oh, bless them. I'm curious about actually publishing a book. Were there any details that surprised you or any things that you hadn't considered?
Do you mean in the sort of editing process?
Yeah, just the editing. And I'm maybe specifically like for the jacket design, it's a beautiful cover. It's kind of like this abstract, almost like water and light thing happening. Mm-hmm. Like, is that something that you had a say in or like had to help them find?
I mean, at a certain point, I mean, it's fascinating. At a certain point, I think I emailed like a ton of images to them, just telling them what I like, just so you get a sense of where I'm thinking. I knew that they wouldn't use them, but I just wanted them to get a feeling. And one of the images that I sent, or a couple of them, were this Japanese photographer had done this kind of, what is it called, like stop time, this sort of photographs of fireflies where you just kind of see these like light bubbles. From the fireflies. They're beautiful photographs, but you know what I mean? Because I'm not thinking of the correct
aperture and all the photography
so
things.
Like getting the blobs of light, kind of, and I thought they were really beautiful. And that doesn't have a direct, I don't even know if whoever designed this looked at that, but I sort of felt later, oh, maybe they did. And actually, there was initially a cover that was similar, but kind of a different color. And looked much like a different book, and then they switched it, and at first I was attached to the first cover, but then after a while I let go of it, I got attached to this cover, so it's very startling, the whole process, because it is like it's a business, and they have to get it right, and they're doing what they're doing, and but I feel, that the publisher that is handling the book are just very, very detail-oriented and very kind of very invested in it. So I was really lucky that way. But ultimately, a lot of these things, they were very interested in hearing my point of view, and I never got into a position where, like, I hated something and they went forward with it. But it's definitely collaboration. It's definitely like they, my editor had very strong views on what would work, and she seems to know better than I do what works.
So. Such a big project. Yeah, it is such a big project, and people, I think, see it as a book, but it's like, yes, it's a book, but there's so many details, and so many different nuances and things to consider and comparison with other books. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and the title, the title's like a perfect example of how it's not really my book. My editor came up with the title after I was trying for like literally boring everybody in my life for a year, trying titles out nonstop. What about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And then finally she suggested it, and I really liked it, and now it feels like, well, that's my title of my book.
Yeah.
But she came up with it. And then the marketing has been interesting because I think they were very careful not to sort of market it as a reincarnation book because they didn't want to sort of alienate kind of mainstream readers. And so that's been just an interesting process.
Yeah, because it's like the scientists, it's very like fact-based. It's not hokey or like spiritual or like, projecting anything on you. It's almost just like this is happening. And
It's not like a... I guess they just wanted to separate it from a fantasy book
Sense. If you try and summarize something down, like, what is that called? Concentrate it down or something, condense it. You lose I don't know, those certain things will jump out at you, which is like a part of the story, you know? Or
right, yeah. Right. But it was interesting, too, though, because on book tour, at one point I was in Marin, you know, and you're talking about Northern California, of all places, and nobody knew in the reading what the book was about because of the careful strategy. So afterwards, I had people say, if I had known this is about reincarnation, like, I know all these people that would have come. So then I thought, oh, okay, maybe now it's time to
yeah.
start talking a little
more. Who knows what the best approach is, you know?
Right. So
I have some questions for you, but I also really think that it's valuable to talk about part of your writing process was almost like getting away from life and the family and the city. It seems like the majority of the book happened on retreats and different writing workshops. Is that true?
You know, certainly a huge chunk of it. I'm not sure I could say. I mean, I also have, I work in a writing space in Brooklyn, so there is a place that I go
oh, okay.
to. But a lot of it was written at colonies. This particular book, a lot at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's a place called Wellspring House. I just seem to, for me, I think there's something about when you're trying to write a novel, and then, you know, I've got kids, and, you know, they'd come home from school around, like, 3, say. So it's like I'd be writing away, and then 2:30, I'd be like, oh, I better go home. They're coming home.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just, like, it would just leave my head, whatever I was doing. And then the next day when you go to sit down, it's almost like you have to start all over again and build the world all over again.
Whereas yeah.
when I go away to colonies, it's like I'm living with these characters night and day. I'm dreaming about the characters. Like, they don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also just, like, a heavenly place. Like,
mm-hmm.
You're fed, you're surrounded by other artists in different disciplines, you know, so you have the painters and the composers and the other writers, so you can talk about your process with the other writers, and then I find actually the visual artists were, like, super helpful with their advice. When I would do a reading, the visual artists would all come, and they'd give me, like, their responses or questions or help, whereas the literary writers are almost, like, too respectful to do that.
Yeah.
So it's just such a stimulating and supportive environment. I really, really got a huge amount out of artist colonies.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing. So I like to end my shows with a rapid fire, and this is just a series of quick questions, and it can be a short answer. The answer can be, I don't know. You ready?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, let's go.
Is there a book that you have not gotten around to reading?
Like, what? You mean that I think I should have read?
Yeah, yeah.
Moby Dick.
Me too. That's a common one, and I think part of it. Yeah, and people that do read it, there's a dichotomy there too. You either love it or you were like, "Whoa, it's awful." So, what book do you remember your parents reading to you?
Winnie the Pooh.
Awesome. It's a classic. Do you have do you have any rituals or routines related to your reading or writing?
Rituals related to reading or writing?
Yeah, like do you have a certain tea or a certain pen or anything that you do to kind of step into that?
I have I drink a lot of coffee. I don't know if it's a ritual. I also have, there's a photograph of a kind of old mentor named Jerry Badanas, who died in like 1995, but he always just feels like a big support. So I kind of had that photograph around, and I have a little postcard that my first writing teacher sent me once, Peter Matheson, and I also just feel very supported by him. So I have kind of those two things I try to keep in the zone, you know, just around me, because it mm-hmm. just sort of fills me with positive, sort of inspiring energy.
Great. Kind of like mentors influence. Not mentors, but like inspiration type support.
Yeah,
things.
Yeah, nice. Mentors and people who inspired me, and just like, you know, just to remind myself that there were people that believed in me.
Yay!
You know, when you're sitting and you're writing stuff, and it seems
lonely.
Like it's really not very good.
Yeah, and you can get lost in your head. There's that echo chamber that's just like all in your head, and you're trying to get it out, but yeah. I noticed that a lot of people have a book that kind of influenced them when they were a teenager. Is there a book that kind of like changed your worldview or made you think about things or feel things that you hadn't before when you were a teenager?
That's a good question. Let's see. I mean, I was very influenced as a young teenager by Jane Eyre, just in terms of like the storytelling. I think I just sort of got swept away by it. And
yes.
I think that was the first thing that I felt like I just fell in love with reading through reading that book. And then a bit later, but it was kind of maybe my later years in high school or even beginning of college, I don't remember when, but I came across White Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys, which is sort of the same, the mad woman in the attic from Jane Eyre, but it's told from her perspective. And it's very spare, beautiful, beautifully written. And it just kind of, that just kind of opened my mind as to just all the different voices that were there. And the also sort of bringing in these kind of marginal voices or these characters that are marginalized in one work and kind of showing that point of view. So I think those two books together had a really big influence.
Wonderful. They're so beautiful to read. You're like, oh, just makes you swoon a little bit. How do you find the books that you read?
That's a good question. I think I'm just kind of always on, you know, I try to read my friends' books or books that have people I know that are coming out, because now there's kind of like a February club. There are all these books that came out around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've become kind of, you know, we're all kind of on the same side in a way. We're all just writers doing our books. And so, like, Idra Novi has a book called Ways to Disappear that I just loved, that I just finished. And Don Tripp has a book called Georgia by Georgia O'Keeffe that I just started. So right now there's a little bit of that. There's also, you know, titles. Somebody suggested a book to me. Actually, it was a bookseller who liked my book on her bookshelf, you know, in the independent bookstore. And she had another book called there, and it was called The Illusion of Separateness, I think. I need to double-check the title.
Okay.
So today I'm drawn to the title, and I forgot it. I'm pretty sure it's called The Illusion of Separateness.
Yeah.
And I really like that concept, and I'm really enjoying that one. And like A Tale for the Time Being. Which
oh, that's
is kind
so
of like
beautiful.
I'm a huge fan of that book, and it also has... I am interested in books that have... a kind of like literary books that have some kind of spiritual or Buddhist sort of aspect to them.
Uh-huh.
So they're not as many as you might think.
Yeah, you get thrown fast. That's why you had to write this book. The world needed another one, right?
I guess. So anyway, so that's kind of how I'm drawn to things. And then sometimes just what everybody's reading, I get sucked into that too. So.
Yeah. What is the best writing advice you've been given?
The best writing advice I've been given? Well, I think...
that's a big question.
Let me think. That's a good question. I think that there's the advice about, like, my old friend Jerry, the one who died ages ago, used to just say, I guess it's a cliche, but it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, which for me was very true, you know, because it really was a marathon. But I think that most people, and I was definitely among them, were so impatient to get our work out that we just, like, we send it to too soon to agents, too soon to editors, too soon trying to sell it, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think you got to be patient, you know? It's probably not ready when you think it is.
Yeah.
Like, give it to more people to read. Like, really, really do everything you could possibly do to it before you give it to an agent, and then they're going to make you make it better, and then do what they say, and then they're going to sell it, and then they're going to make it better, and it's just not going to be over when you think it's going to be over. So just kind of... relax.
Like,
about
get
that.
Into a nice slow stride and just, you know, step by step. I love that.
Yeah, just try not to grasp at, like, I got to get this book out there.
Yeah.
And definitely not like, oh, I need money, so I'm going to get the book out
there.
No. Like, that's just never going to work.
It's not going to be good for
never
you.
Work.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for chatting with me this afternoon. And I just really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. This is fantastic, and I'm just so grateful to be a part of your show. So thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. I will let you go. I'm sure you have busy family things to do this weekend.
My son came in. I don't think you could tell. I was in the middle of the reading, and I hear this, like, banging on the window. So
oh,
I was
no.
like, he's going to have to figure out how to get in.
I'm like, sorry.
He made it into the house, so he made it into the house.
Oh, who?
So,
thanks.
than Letterman. Okay, well, thank you again. And yes, again, the name of my book is The Forgetting Time, and you can look it up on my website's theforgettingtime.com or find it in usual places.
Yeah, and I'll post all the links on the podcast that will go out, and support your local bookstore. Get it from them.
Absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch soon. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Swan.
Mm-hmm. Bye. So that was Sharon Guskin, The Forgetting Time. We opened up with a big excerpt, so if you tuned in the middle somewhere, make sure you check that out next week. You can find the podcast on Stitcher, Audio Boom, or iTunes. And I will leave you with a word, duplicitous.